There are worlds out there where the sky is burning, where the sea is asleep and the rivers dream. People made of smoke, cities made of song. Somewhere there's danger, somewhere there's injustice. Somewhere else, the tea is getting cold. Come on, Ace. We've got work to do. I'm Rose Bailey, and this is Genreless.
I love it!
Hello and welcome to Genreless, where we're doing one more extra Seventh Doctor episode because we can't stop talking about the Seventh Doctor.
But Eddie, this is the worst run of the classic Doctor Who.
You can get the hell out of my podcast right now.
Yeah, this season is one of the best seasons of classic Who. You can see the problems. But yeah, this is the season where you've got Ace and the Doctor in the form everyone remembers them as.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And my favorite version of them. Yes. And I think this is one of the defining seasons from the series from here onward.
I love that you have, without knowing what we've recorded, succinctly summarized what Chris and I took 3 hours to come to over the previous two episodes.
How there would be no modern iteration of how it is without this season of Doctor Who at all.
Definitely. There are, when you look at Davies' relaunch, there are things from the classic series that you can point right at. And one of them is this season. One of the things that you can see in the 2005 relaunch, you can see elements of a lot of previous seasons and Doctors. And this season has several episodes that do that. The Doctor breaking Ace's... I'm going to skip forward for this next paragraph to Moffat. But the Doctor breaking Ace's faith in him to trap Fenric is 100% an 11th Doctor to Amy move.
Yeah.
But as going back to 2005, you've got a companion with a life.
Mm-hmm.
And friends back home.
Mm-hmm.
Others had mentioned it. Tegan talks a fair amount about people in her life.
We got to see Tegan's aunt too.
Yeah, but you know, like, you don't go. Going back to Perryvale in this episode is fundamentally the same kind of thing that we had with basically every TV companion after this in some form or another. And especially with Doctor and with the ninth and 10th Doctor and the, Rose. Kind of weird to say that name on the air.
But, right.
not complaining that there is that... there was a companion named Rose. Well, not named for, surprisingly, but that would be okay if I was. Now you've got a trans girl named Rose.
Mm-hmm.
Which is pretty awesome from, my perspective. Yeah. This episode going back to Perryvale is a lot like going back to the Powell Estates. The kinds of threats they face throughout this season are very 2005 kinds of threats.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of one that wouldn't be that wouldn't be out of place, or that one threat that would be out of place from this season. And I can't think of any of them.
I mean, honestly, and we talked about this a little bit, is that season 26 really is kind of a season zero RTD. A lot of things you say, for life, for example, I mean, it has the RTD style of mashup, where you know, like, they'll take Arthurian Knights and mash it up with Unit. There we go. Take a new thing and a classic thing and sham them together. Let's take a historical trip that also secretly it tells you something about one of your companion's inner lives, you know, Ghostlight. And then, of course, the Fenric is the Doctor being kind of a manipulative jerk and making it seem like he has it all together, but in fact, we as the audience realize he's making it up as he goes along, which is Curse of Fenric / the Pandorica opens, effectively.
Yeah.
And then, this one's probably the most, because there's this idea that the traditional Doctor Who companion now is a young girl from modern-day London, but really in the classic era, there's, as far as I know, there's only two characters that fit that mold, which is Sarah Jane and Ace.
Yeah. What about Polly?
About what?
What about poor Polly? Polly was right. A young girl from London, if I'm not mistaken.
You're right. Polly does also qualify. Does Zoe qualify? I don't think so.
No, wasn't Zoe from the 25th century? So technically she was a young, brilliant scientist.
But she wasn't from London.
True.
Right. No. That's Zoe.
Wasn't she from the Wheel in Space?
There's another girl from the first Doctor era. She had a black flat cap.
Dodo,
that's what I'm thinking of.
I think Dodo does count. I'm trying to remember specifically where she's from, but she's
still familiar. Like all of them. Ultimately, the arc was get back to London and then you pretty much get off the ship.
Right.
This is the first time where the companion who's from London gets off of London and continues on afterwards.
Yeah. And this is, I think this might be the first, Ace might be the first companion who refers to the TARDIS as home.
Mm-hmm. I think Sarah Jane maybe does, but I may be mistaken.
Sarah Jane would be the only one I would think of who might have. Right. But looking forward to the future of the show, this is someone who has a life and doesn't ditch it at the end of this episode, but thinks of the TARDIS as their life now.
Right.
As their home. You know, you've got that, I'm stumbling here. You've got the bit where Rose's mom says, someday there will be a woman in a bazaar on an alien world, and she'll be somebody else.
Yeah.
She says that to Rose. And This is kind of, not explicitly, but this is where Ace goes and does that. And, although how much time the audios and the novels take is, you know, confusing in the usual Doctor Who way.
Right.
That goes on for a long time. The Ace travels with the Doctor, I'd say, at least as much as any other TV companion.
Right. And it's interesting because, I mean, obviously the show was canceled unbeknownst to anybody until like they're in the middle of recording this serial. So they had plans for Ace after this, but even within the context of that, right? Like for the 2005 version of the series, Rose and other companions ultimately come and go from modern day Earth, which is really modern day London, occasionally Cardiff dressed as London. But there's something that always draws them back. Their characters or connections or whatever to draw them back. What's fascinating about Ace in Survival is that she's like, hey, I'd like to see my friends. Although that happens off screen. She goes to see her friends. She has a venture and goes, you know what? Nah. And just bails, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas... you know, again, Sarah Jane being the biggest example, she does eventually say, I want to go home. And then the doctor's like, okay, cool. I got called to Gallifrey. And Sarah's like, oh, no, I got it. It was a Gallifrey, right? That's the closest we ever got in classic era to something like that, where it's like Sarah's like, maybe I would go, maybe I would keep traveling with you, because I have to see that part at least. And mm-hmm. then she gets dumped off in some place that's not even Croydon, as we learn. Which is, but I think it has to be the yardstick for the longest running gag to have her dropped off in Croydon and have her bitch about that literally like four decades later. but I mean, I think other, also to your point, is that this is the only season where a companion has an actual character arc, which is something that becomes very prominent in the new series.
Oh, yeah, good point.
That was one of the objectives of the Andrew Cartmell and the crew when they wrote it, is they wanted to add the mystery back to the Doctor. And by doing that, they had to shift focus, and they focused all that on the companion, which is why you get the development of the character, how we do. And mm-hmm. for the cancellation piece, Cartmell found out it was going to be canceled when they were sort of recording the first, basically the first episode. And he quickly wrote the epic speech that you just read and gave it to McCoy to do. So he knew it was coming and did that so he could have a capstone for all the fans and still to allude that the show's not over. We just don't get to see the adventures they're having.
Right.
Yeah. Actually, the way that speech is on screen, it was probably ADR, right?
Yeah, it was.
Like, they probably had, and correct me if I'm wrong, I just haven't seen anything about this. That was probably something they had McCoy do in the studio a week or so later, right? When doing ADR. But I'm not sure about that.
I think what happens, it's been a while since I've read the document or watched documentary on this, but I think what happened was, we're both right. In fact, that Cartman was happening, and so he's like, okay, I want you to go walk in that direction, talk to each other. And then Cartmell was writing the speech, and he's like, just so you know kind of roughly how long it's going to be and what we're talking about, so you can get a sense of what kind of body gestures to make. And then, yeah, they brought McCoy in later to ADR the dialogue when they were putting it together for post-production. So it's a little bit of both in that regard. But it was very fast. It was very clearly tacked on. And I mean, good on Cartmell, because it would have been very easy to have done something like, okay, I'm going to leave Ace here and go on by myself, right? That mm-hmm. could have been an extremely easy decision to make. It was good on Cartmell for integrity purposes, like, no, Ace wouldn't do that, even though we're ending here, and that would be easy to do. Let's do the right thing. Mm-hmm. And that led to the Wilderness Years of spinoffs.
Except for the Fox movie that then jettisoned all that and had the Doctor by himself.
Yes, but the Doctor was also much older, and the Doctor doesn't age fast.
Right. So clearly, hundreds of years later, because he's forgotten that submachine guns hurt.
But also, if you want to say that, we could look at Tennant, who says he's 900, and we know at this point the Doctor should be 900, so maybe they age too fast.
I mean, well, yeah, it clearly happens in fits and starts. I really enjoyed the line to the Fifth Doctor when he returns. You're older. So are you.
Yes.
A great dodge for that whole thing. Also, I mean, like, this is just fan stuff, but the after the whole thing with survival, mm-hmm. it's quite possible that Seven just didn't want to take Ace on the ferrying the Master's remains run. Like, you know, I mean, it's fairly clear at the beginning, even though the Doctor is surprised by the specific incident, it's mm-hmm. fairly clear that, you know, the Master's definitely going to pull something here.
Right.
Seven knows it there. So, yeah. Actually, I think the, like, 5 to 15 minutes that McCoy is in the TV movie are very accurately Seventh Doctor.
Oh, yeah.
And Several of the people who worked on that have said that the BBC wanted to use four. As was before the actual script was written, but when things were when the licensing deal was in its long period of hell, mm-hmm. The BBC wanted to start with four regenerating into the new Doctor for the new series, because they figured that Americans mostly hadn't seen the Seventh Doctor yet.
That's an interesting point.
So, yeah. About this episode, there's actually one other relation I want. Well, maybe two, but one of the things that I wanted to talk about is that this is also a very Third Doctor story and a very Delgado Master story. You have a different introductory device.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the more going back home thing. It's not a unit story, but like, what have we got here? We've got a strange phenomenon making people disappear one by one. The Doctor seems to be looking at the wrong thing. Mm-hmm. We go along. When the Doctor gets to the Cat People planet,
mm-hmm.
the Master has been doing this all along.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, that's how the Master shows up in so many. The Master has a big plan based on a dying planet. The big plan, while not inherently stupid, is obviously going to blow up in the Master's face, and the Doctor can tell. as soon as the Master starts, as soon as Ainley starts talking about the Master's plan, the mm-hmm. Doctor is like, this is a bad idea, right?
Right.
And the Master's like, oh no, Doctor, I know what I'm doing. the plan proceeds to blow up in the Master's face.
Right. Surprising everyone.
That's exactly the way the Doctor knew and suggested that it would.
Mm.
And then the Master appears to be doomed. And presumably if there had been another season, we would have had another Master episode.
Right.
With not much explanation about how he survived, except that we know the Master is generally resourceful enough to do that. Mm-hmm. So it's very Third Doctor, I think.
Since we're kind of talking about the episode itself, do we want to transition just into the summary and we kind of break it down by the different episodes?
Sure. I'll handle the first episode. I'll summarize it real quick.
Oh.
The Seventh Doctor brings Ace back to her hometown of Perivale in the suburbs of northwest London. A mysterious black cat is wandering around and humans are hunted down and made to disappear to another world. Ace grows worried as most of her old friends seem to have disappeared along with several others, but the Doctor is preoccupied with the behavior of the strange cat. It becomes apparent that it is controlled by a strange being in another world, viewing Perivale through its eyes and choosing which humans to chase and transport. An unhappy young man named Stuart is the next victim. Ace follows soon afterwards, hunted down by a cheetah person on horseback while hunting affinity for the curious cat. The Doctor and a keep fit instructor known as Patterson are the next to be chosen and teleported to another world, bathed in a blood red sky, where the Doctor finds his nemesis, the Master, greeting him. That's episode one. And it's watching this again. I mean, I knew when we picked this one and we were talking to everyone about this, I knew that the Rusty Davies analogies were going to be really hard to avoid. So I watched it with that in mind. And it's surprising how fast an entire secondary cast of characters is built up in just 22 minutes.
And that's very tight writing.
Mm-hmm.
I assume it's because of it being a fairly short serial that it's done that way.
Right.
But yeah, this is very quick establishment. If this had been like a 4 or 5 episode serial, we probably wouldn't have gotten the establishment of the supporting characters until 2 or 3.
Right. It probably would have been something more along the lines of like, we meet those characters and they just start disappearing one at a time. And then after episode 2 is when we actually go to the new planet, and the second half of the serial is on a new planet. But because we didn't have that time, it's a lot more of Ace telling the Doctor and occasionally other characters about the supporting cast that we're about to meet in episode 2.
Yeah. Can I read part 2? Because I've got a few comments there.
Oh, yeah, sure. But let's, is there anything you want to talk about with part 1, Chris?
I was just going to ask, have you ever been in that northwest suburb of London now that you live there?
I actually haven't, although I did, I'm curious, I did look it up, and apparently Perry Vale is largely residential, so I don't really have a reason to go there. But that being said, I'm moving to North London, so I'll be close to Perry Vale soon.
Have you ended up in Croydon?
Not yet. I really should get like a walking tour of London of Doctor Who places now that we're talking about it.
That could be a second business that you start right there.
Right. And over here is the place where Sarah Jane Smith was accidentally dropped off.
I mean, that bit, if you were doing a walking tour or a bus tour or something, that bit would be the crowning bit.
True. Just drop them off in the middle of nowhere. There you go. Figure it out.
Of where you're going to do the next tour spot.
Right. But I mean, go ahead.
Go ahead.
I will say at least that I've not been to Perivale specifically, but I mean, I have been to some of the more residential parts of London, and it does look a lot like that. You know, just a bunch of row houses, the occasional shop kind of stuck on a corner here and there. So watching it again, I was like, oh, okay, that actually does look pretty familiar to places I've been around, obviously, several decades older, but I mean, the same kind of vibe, you know, the youth center, the charity shop, that kind of stuff. These are all relative staples of those kinds of areas from what I've seen.
Just want to say that the contrast of them coming to what would have then been modern London to be the final episode is fairly stark compared to where they were previously for the adventures. And it's a good counterbalance, even from when they showed up in Battlefield, that was slightly in the future. And it has a very right. different vibe to it. And it's like,
depending interesting on the day, experience.
Right. Right. Is it 10 years in the future or not? Maybe kind of, sort of. But yeah, I mean, and again, to your point, Chris, like, it's also really interesting just how low stakes this is, right? I mean, literally last episode, the Doctor was fighting God. The episode before that, he was talking to angels. And the episode before that, he was fighting the Queen of the Fae. And now he's kicking around fucking Perry Vale.
Chasing a cat.
Right, chasing a cat. And this is one of those times where one reason I love season 26 is because, like, it's a Star Trek's a great story on its own. Don't get me wrong. You can watch it in isolation. I've watched it in isolation. It's great. But watching it as the end of season 26, you kind of get the vibe of, like, he's lost it a bit. You know, it's like, he's had a really rough few serials, and now he's chasing a cat. And so when Ace is going, you see conspiracies everywhere, we as the audience know, obviously, it's not true because that's what the show's not like that. But there's that half second of, like, well, maybe she's got a point because we have seen some shit in this season.
Yeah.
All right. Anything else about episode 1 before we move on?
No.
All right, Rose, go ahead.
The Tremas Master is evidently unwell. His eyes and mouth show feline characteristics, and he uses the black cat, a kitling, to create a dimensional bridge for the cheetah people to hunt prey on Earth. This is the Delgado Master here. His reasons are unclear. He seems keen to keep the cheetah people occupied. He tells the Doctor the planet is alive and has a bewitching influence. The Indigenes bred the kitlings and had a great civilization then regressed into animals, which, you know, when you think about cats, that's probably more fun for them. The master is beginning to show changes and needs the doctor's help to escape. Ace has seen some of her friends, Shreela and Midge, hiding in the woods with a young man called Derek. The planet is clearly dangerous. Yes. The Time Lord deduces that they are an ancient dying planet. A cheetah person hunts and kills a terrified milkman, prompting a cheetah pack to attack the doctor. Again, we see this a lot more in other doctors than in Seven.
Yeah.
A cheetah... Oh, that was Milkman again. During the fight, Midge kills one cheetah person and Ace injures another, called Kara. Ace forms an attachment to her and tends her injuries. Ace is both fulfilling the role of the companion here, and come on, Ace is gay.
Right.
Kara is intrigued by Captain Soren's shiny cap insignia, which Ace has on her jacket, and gently paws at it. This worries the doctor. He says that the only way they can return to Earth is if one of them turns into a cheetah person and brings his prey home. That happens with Midge, and the master uses him to return to Earth. Kara appears again, and Ace's eyes change as she begins to transform into a cheetah herself. So, like, I don't want to push this part of my headcanon too far, but have you ever seen Ace relate to a male supporting character? Like, in The Curse of Fenric, her attempt at seduction is bizarre.
Yes, yes.
She is doing the thing that every companion will do. Although, especially Rose, Donna, and Rory. But she's doing the thing where she makes friends with an unlikely supporting cast member.
Right.
And seeing that and seeing Ace go from being the viewpoint character, which she always was less than previous companions, mm-hmm. but she as the viewpoint character here is developing the human side of the story. Mm-hmm. Again, that's something we see a lot later. It's something we see all throughout this season.
Right.
And now that I think about it, it's also what Sarah Jane used to do.
Yeah.
This isn't a doctor who can't talk to people. But this is a case. Or Seven can talk to people, even if he's kind of odd.
Right.
But Ace is there throughout much of this season, and arguably through her whole run, to introduce the human side of the story. So I think that's a signature for Ace.
Yeah, I mean, to your point, like we talked about this when we talked about Battlefield, right? Like when she runs into show, immediately she's like, let's grab a beer and go off and have a conversation, talk about explosives. And it's like,
which one of the acest things ever.
Right. It's like, I'm going to hit on this pretty girl with beer and explosives. And I'm like, that's just peak Dorothy McShane. But then you're right. It's like her flirting in Fenric is a bit awkward. And I charitably said, it's like, you could read that as just teenage awkwardness, like, you know, how teenagers think adults flirt and her just missing the mark. But you're right. Kara again, and she's like, so immediately like going to Kara, it's like going, let me take care of you. Let me help you out, honey. And it's just like, okay, come on. There's always so many ways you can position this to at least like at least pansexual, you know.
Right. And I think she's not into guys. Ghost Light, she goes to a girl's room and plays dress up.
Oh yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And they are both, you know, grown-up like people.
Right.
Yeah. What we, I mean, you know, I think Ace is some form of gay, but the larger point is that even if she isn't, she bonds with people very fast.
Yeah.
Mainly women, but, you know, she's one of the companions who does that.
Yeah, I mean, arguably that goes back to day one, right? Because she bonded very quickly with Mel in Dragonfire.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly. That's another person who was fairly interested in the subject of blowing things up. I mean, you don't expect that from a computer programmer necessarily. Or at least, you know, you didn't in the 80s.
I'll say I do now, but yes.
I mean, that's, you know, you only get a bit of it, but that's kind of a new side to Mel.
Yeah.
They go back to Ace's tiny room, and Ace starts talking about, you know, bombs and how bombs can solve their problem. And I was like, yeah, that scans.
Which, I mean, tells you everything you need to know about Mel's life experiences at that point, though.
Yeah. I mean, that's probably the most fun thing any supporting cast member has ever given Mel the opportunity to do.
True.
We're going to bomb our way through that door? Yes!
I don't have to scream, Monkey. So I do want to take a step, because we, for bizarre reasons, we've actually never covered Anthony Ainley's story yet.
Oh!
It's weird. It's just the way these choices came about, we just haven't really hit one of his stories. And I've always felt, and I'm probably biased because this is one of my favorite seasons, but I've always felt this is Anthony Ainley at his best as the Master.
Yeah, and I think you've got the benefit here of him having had a long run as the Master at this point.
Yeah.
I'm sure that nobody has, definitely nobody has more episodes as the Master, except possibly Delgado. But yeah,
I think only gets it only because those 70s seasons were just really long. I think it may be the only reason why.
And he was in so many of them, they thought he was a permanent cast member.
Right.
I mean, basically was his first year.
And that caused him problems getting other work because he wasn't really a permanent cast member and everyone thought that he was.
Yeah.
He was like, please, this is not my show. Hire me for other things.
So, but like, Ainley is very experienced with the character at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see that. He's very comfortable as the character to the point that you can see him playing his version of the Master, even when the Master is not at his instinctual best.
Yeah.
Well, this portrayal is almost vastly different than every other portrayal he had of the character up to this point. It's almost like he decided to stop trying to be over the top or being a pale imitation of Delgado and went a completely different direction. And it worked.
I think, I mean, it helped that
writing him as his own character by now.
Yeah, I mean that I mean, it was written better, but also I think it's another case is that McCoy can match Delgado's tenor. Davidson is a very subtle actor, and so sometimes Ainley's kind of inadvertently acting Davidson a bit off the screen by being a little over the top and kind of overwhelming Davidson's performance a bit, whereas McCoy can match bombast to bombast, and I think that both helps smooth Ainley's performance out, but also, to your point, Rose, yeah, he also has better writing and also has much more experience here. There's a bit of it's frankly just a unique situation for Ainley to be in, because I don't think he was ever in any of the Colin Baker stories, was he?
He was. There was a one with the Ronnie and the Master.
Oh, right. So the Ronnie was there, so there wasn't really a time to have the two of them go. But
that's actually a a really good story. Just in general, the Ronnie stuff is far better than you would think from her character concept. But anyway, I'm just saying that Six and the Ronnie come off really well.
Right, I think to go into Six a little bit, but I mean, I think what happened with that one was they were kind of positioning Ronnie as kind of the sixth version of the Master. It's the Master's there to kind of help carry the torch over for Ronnie. So there wasn't really a direct Master Doctor thing. So Collins Bombast was being matched by I forget her name already. Who played the Ronnie?
Kate O'Mara.
Thank you. O'Mara's just no selling that Bombast, which is the best way to play it. McCoy brings a different kind of Bombast. I'm sorry?
I said that's what you want from a mad scientist.
Right. Whereas McCoy brings a different kind of vibe. Again, he's a little more experienced, settled into his not quite master manipulator role thing. And so Ainley and McCoy end up being very perfectly matched. And it's just, frankly, a shame we don't see more of them together, because just the two episodes we see them in this, it's like I want to see a Delgado length run between these two incarnations. You know?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And that doesn't even happen much in the novels.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember, in fact, I mean, I know I have read something in the with the Seventh Doctor and the Tramas Master. But
the new adventures, you mean?
The Virgin New Adventures. I feel like I've seen that. But like, no, basically it's something that no one really did much of. I mean, unfortunately, because Anley passed away early.
Well, right. But,
like, for like the audios, that's why that doesn't happen. But it really doesn't happen in the novels. Look, I remember a lot of those novels, and I think it happened, but I don't remember. That I think says something. I don't know. Anyway, I'm agreeing with Eddie's point that this is something I wish we'd had more of from these actors, and failing that, from these characters.
Yeah, I'm doing a quick search, and bizarrely, he actually shows up more in the Eighth Doctor novels than he does in the Virgin novels, which is...
Well, I mean, in some ways, Eight is a character who demands the Master more, personality-wise.
No, true.
Like, Eight kind of needs that bright, scheming opponent in a way that Seven only does when he comes up against gods.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's always the add the mystery back to the Doctor thing.
Right.
And I think, you know, having experience, obviously not nearly on this scale, but having franchise experience, it is very dangerous to try to add mystery to something by knowing exactly what it is. That probably would have been a little bit of an issue if they'd gone on with Seven. But this season, it works perfectly because they're just starting to establish it.
Right.
Yeah, obviously, I'm not anywhere near this scale of a franchise. I've just, you know, seen how that works and how it doesn't on the small scale.
No, totally. I mean, to digress slightly into work stuff, I mean, you and I have both done that for our various vampire franchises on some level, right? It's the, here's this really well-known franchise. Now we need to pretend like there's new stuff that you don't know about. How do we make that work?
I always came up with multiple possibilities there.
Mm-hmm.
But you can also really do it wrong at, where you play the thing, where you play the mystery too long, even though you know the answer.
Yeah.
So in Evil Mind, there was a space empress who was the heir to the throne,
mm-hmm,
of the space Catholics.
Space Catholics.
She had been killed.
Right.
But she was brought back to life in this secret facility, surrounded by scientists and politicians. Mm-hmm. And she grabs the throne again because apparently she's a telepath. The only one in the franchise. I don't think there even was one after her. But the reveal, which was a really good reveal that we just strung out too long, is that she's only telepathic with the people who were in the facility where she was resurrected. And, you know, if you did something like that on Doctor Who, you know, for a supporting character, a villain or something, I mean, I always thought that the Empress had a point, but, you know, that's a character that you could have put against, against a version of the Doctor, but you can't play a mystery like that too long. She's dead again, by the way, as of about 6 years ago, I think.
No.
You know, in a universe where no one can die.
Yeah, you know, like you do.
But then the Daleks came in last year, so, you know, I don't really know where the lore is at on the franchise I used to work on.
That's true.
Yeah, so there's a play of mystery too long, and in the case, bring you back to the Seventh Doctor. I don't know that necessarily happened, but there was a lot of Seventh Doctor media that never got anywhere near the Cardinal Master Plan.
Yeah.
And that enabled later showrunners to do some very cool stuff. But at the same time, you know, I just want those two more seasons, one more with Ace, that we were planning to get with, that they were planning to give us with Seven. Because here, the writers have hit their stride.
Mm-hmm.
The actors have definitely hit their stride.
Mm-hmm.
And the serials are all about the right length for the stories they're telling.
Mm-hmm.
And while I'd call this the second best 7 Ace story, that's not because it's not really good.
Oh, yeah.
Curse of Fenric is my favorite because you have a class act villain there.
Yeah.
Who is established very quickly. Mm-hmm. You know, you have someone who can stand against Seven. And certainly here we see the Master do that. But like Fenric, you got this guy you just brought in, and he can stand against Sylvester McCoy. And that's both an acting and a writing thing that works really well. And the bringing the mystery back to the Doctor this season very nicely doesn't contradict it. Like, it just means the Doctor has been at this, and, you know, we get this later in Chibnall. And by the way, I'm a fan of that mythology. You know, like, but we get what I'm about to say, we get the same thing later. But, like, we have this mystery added back to the Doctor that doesn't disorient you at all about who Seven is. You know, saying that the initial conversation about their previous chess game doesn't undermine your perception of who the Seventh Doctor is. It just tells you you don't know things about the Doctor.
Right.
And then we keep getting that up until the end. The little hints of the lonely god, to use a later epithet, don't undermine who Seven is. Really not any of the previous Doctors, but they don't contradict. It's not a this changes everything X-Men issue. It's here there's some things you don't know about. You know, and I really think that works well. And this is not quite the manipulator Doctor that we see in some other episodes. I think in some ways that's... I'm going to say there's a separate trait for manipulation that we see here, which is as defining to the Seventh Doctor's manipulation. He does things indirectly. He is just an indirect dude. And until he's possessed by the power of an alien planet in this episode, in this story, everything he does is indirect.
Mm-hmm.
Seven as a as written is great at that. And McCoy can just play that distracted looking at the wrong thing. And you know it's important because, you know, we know how Doctor Who works. But also, you don't see how that's going to work. What does the indirect thing the Doctor is working on do?
Mm-hmm.
That's Seven from the beginning in a way. Oh gosh, I'm dominating the conversation. I'll finish up. That's Seven from the beginning, more than the manipulator being developed later.
Right. And I mean, some context that you don't understand is that we had not covered any season 24 or 25 stuff, but I've come out as kind of a season 24 apologist because I do feel like it's not inconsistent with the Seventh Doctor. Rather, it is Seventh Doctor growing into this role. Because even Time and the Ronnie, which I argue is, like you say, it's better than people give it credit for. But even in that, he has a plan. It's just that that plan is lost under regeneration trauma, right? Chris, did you have any thoughts about this episode?
No, I'm good. Thank you, though.
I feel like I really shouldn't be talking over the historian. I got these tags on my screen. Top of the screen, Eddie. Second, the historian. I really feel like I should not be arguing with you about history.
You're a guest in our virtual home, so we will always give you the floor, let you give your full intake and opinions, because for us, this is our third time talking about McCoy. And so some of it we've said, and people have heard us do it. Your opinions are like fresh and they're here to hear you speak.
Although it does remind me of my favorite line from the Star Beast of like, my preferred pronoun is the.
the definite article.
Yes. That's a great
our running gag is every time we do one of these, I have a different name just for Eddie. So you can always see whatever it is going to be randomly put up this week.
Yes.
But yeah. I have, you know, the Star Beast is also kind of this season descended, even though that's not the origin of the origin era of the comic it was based on.
Right.
But you see, I usually think of Seven as kind of a predecessor to 11.
Mm-hmm.
But you see a lot of that in 10 and 14. Nine is an improviser. Right. He's got a plan, but he's not concealing that he's making shit up as he goes along. Right. The Seventh Doctor, you don't know until the end how much he was or was not improvising.
Right.
Because sometimes, he's making shit up as he goes along. And sometimes it's just that he was prodding in the right, in a fruitful direction. There's a Cornell story, prose, where he has Seven think to himself that he can either know the future or he can change it, but only one of those things.
Mm.
And I think that's a great observation about how Seven operates.
Yeah.
Like, it's a cool bit of lore. That I really wish more of the Seven stuff had used, but also it's just a description of this era of the character.
Right. And that's one of the things I love about Battlefield, going back a little bit, is one of the small moments in Battlefield is when he is confronted and called Merlin for the first time. We as the audience know he does not know that he is Merlin. So to see him seamlessly step into that role, claim the title of Merlin, and start throwing his weight around, we see him improvising, but we see him do it in a way that is consistent with the way that he looks like he's planning. So it's a nice way to start the season off by saying, you don't know which is which. It's a small little bit of world building that really, again, it was very clear Hartnell's thinking of this whole season as a unit, which I think is the first time outside of maybe The Key to Time, even that's debatable, someone really thought about a whole season as a unit. I don't count the Trial of the Time Lord because that's just...
I think Trial of the Time Lord tried to be thought of as a unit.
It's not.
It doesn't come together, but I do think that was where they started.
Oh, sure. Episode 1, it's like, cool, we're doing this unit. And episode 3, it's like, okay, just put stuff on the screen. Dear God, I don't care.
I always think of that season as kind of Star Trek. In the sense that we are shown definitive evidence, or we are shown something that appears to be definitive evidence, we as the audience know that it doesn't make sense for it to be that, so we're waiting for the reveal. But the problem is that although the reveal is pretty good, the reveal itself makes sense and fits in with the mythology and all that.
Mm-hmm.
But the episodes in between, why are we being shown this false evidence? What was the point of any of this? The episodes don't hold up the pretty good bookends.
Exactly. So the framing device is more interesting than the thing it's framing.
Right. And that helps the season a lot, but, you know, it doesn't save it.
No.
I wonder what kind of re-edit you could do on that.
I have seen people try to edit just the court scenes together, and it doesn't hold up well.
I was thinking, well, the reason I'm thinking about this is that the BBC, I'm trying to remember the name, but it was on the BBC America service. They did a series of 22 minute episodes that recapped each doctor with both guests from the original cast and guests from later casts being interviewed.
Was that the Doctor Who Confidentials?
No, I don't think so. But I'm sorry, I'm blanking on the title. But you do get a lot of interesting bits. And the sixth episode has maybe 5 minutes or less of total footage from Trial of a Time Lord. But the recap is decent. The 5 minute version with commentary from the actors.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it shows that the basic premise works.
Right. And to answer your question, Rose, it was the Doctors Revisited.
Oh, yes. I mean, should probably get back from 6 on to 7. But what, and I'm about to go back to 5. The thing that is interesting is when the doctors, or when the actors who played the doctors start have being fans of the series because they were kids when it was going on. Mm-hmm. That starts with Peter Davison, who just loved the Second Doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And then Peter Davison ends up the inspiration and then the father-in-law of David Tennant.
Right.
You know, it's interesting to see because at this point, I don't know what knowledge of the show Sylvester McCoy had.
Mm-hmm.
But you can tell he gets what the series has been up to, until this point.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how much that was just, you know, how he was briefed when he came into the role, and how much it was that he had watched or researched the series. But he does, through his performance, clearly illustrate that he knows what previous versions of the character were like.
From some of my reading, I think I had, he'd watched the Second Doctor, but then he started ramping and preparing once he got the role.
Which stood out to me, we talked about it a little bit, but like, it's fascinating to me that the Second Doctor is much more the template for many of the incarnations of Doctor than the First Doctor. Like the only incarnation of the post-First Doctor that really seems like it was directly inspired by Hartnell is probably 12.
Yeah.
Everyone else has a lot, like, five has a lot of two in him. Seven's got a lot of two in him. 11's got a lot of two in him. There's a lot of the Second Doctor in quite a few of the incarnations. So yeah, to your point, it's fascinating. It took the Second Doctor to really put the stamp on the Doctor's character, whereas Hartnell, for both good and bad reasons, is perhaps kind of glossed over in terms of that reinvention.
Well, I agree, and I can point at a specific Second Doctor story that I think becomes the template, just because I ended up watching it again a month or two ago for not research or anything, just kind of randomly picked it. Tomb of the Cybermen is what almost every Doctor Who story after Tomb of the Cybermen is. The setup, the types of characters, the supporting cast having an internal conflict that makes them do really foolish things, mostly plausibly.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to see that again as the main mode with the Fourth Doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, then it that format, that story sticks with, you know, basically everything after, including this episode. Although we don't have some middle-aged man who's very serious about his position in this one, which is also something that starts with Tomb of the Cybermen, I think.
Right.
But well, still, there's a lot of that.
You could argue that's Patterson. The military ?
Yeah.
Guy that's like training all the toxic masculinity in the gym.
Thank you. I was going to remark on is the fact that one aspect of the series that aged really well is Patterson is, if you wrote this today, it would have been a checklist of toxic masculinity traits. The fact it's done in 89, it's like shows you that this stuff's been around for a lot longer than people think it has.
And it shows that even those kind of Doctor Who stock characters are very deliberately developed. In really most of the stories, even the ones that aren't very good, there's a clear intention about those characters who seem to show up over and over.
Right, exactly. But I mean, to your point, like I even made the comments that Curse of Fenric near the end becomes a base under siege story. If you put the vicar in the role of the person who takes his position too seriously, although it's a very inverted take on it, then yeah, it's pretty much Tomb of the or the moon base, more accurately. It's pretty much the moon base redone just with vampires. And
infinitely better already.
Well, right. I mean, anything's better with vampires, as we well know.
Oh, yeah. Sorry,
Hemivores.
Oh, I love Hemivores.
I don't think anyone was really disguising that those were vampires. I think Curse of Fenric is one of those stories where everybody clearly knows what they're dealing with. Nobody's pretending it's not that in character or out of character, but the Doctor puts a label on it.
Well, right. Because a lot of it was J&T didn't want it to be associated with Tom Baker and vampires that way. So he's like, they can't be vampires. And Cartmell and the rest of them went, okay, they're hemivores.
Right.
It's like the various times in the 2005 Onward run where people refer to something as zombies. And right. The Doctor is mildly annoyed. Everybody gets where that's coming from. Again, right. In character and out of character. Actually, I remember when I was introducing a friend of mine to Doctor Who, long, long time ago, 20 years ago, or close to, and we're sitting in the living room of two of my other friends, and my friend Sarah is explaining the format of the show. And she says, now, the Doctor does a lot of running away.
Mm-hmm.
And T goes, Well, so he doesn't get caught that often? And Sarah goes, yes, he fights a lot of zombies. I'm like, yeah, basically.
You're not wrong.
As you mentioned, Sarah and Daniel, who had seen every single episode of Doctor Who, so that is a very distilled opinion.
So good. Is there anything else on episode 2 that we need to chat about?
That's me for episode 2.
Okay. Guess you good?
Yeah.
Hey, do you want to read part 3, Chris?
I guess I can. So we'll all have read some like. Ace abandons the doctor to go hunting with Kira, but he eventually wins her around. Midge has fallen to the power of the planet and is turning into a beast. The master seizes onto this and has Midge teleport back to Earth, away from the dying world. He possesses Midge and goes with him to the youth club, using his hypnotic powers to enslave Patterson students. The doctor persuades Ace to help him return to Perivale, also letting Patterson, Derek, Sheila flee the planet. Patterson insists that nothing is amiss, falling back on his survival of the fittest mantras and self-defense classes. The doctor and Ace roam Perivale in search of Midge and the master. They find them at a youth club. They have killed Patterson for sport. Midge, too, is killed in the master's machinations. Kira's arrival brings comfort to Ace, whose transformation continues. But the master kills Kira, too. As she dies, she transforms into a human being, Lisa Bowerman, who will become Benny in the future, her metamorphosis having been reversed by death. With her final breath, Kira praises the hunt before another cheetah person teleports her dead body away. Meanwhile, the doctor catches up to the master and finds him trying to pick the lock to the TARDIS. The master gloats that he is capable of controlling the raw power given to him by the planet and declares that he will use it to destroy the doctor before grabbing him and taking him back to the cheetah planet for a final confrontation. In the ensuing struggle, the master starts out having the upper hand, but the doctor, drawing from the planet's power, manages to turn the tables on him. As soon as he has him at his mercy, he raises a skull to bash him with it, much like the first doctor tried to bash a caveman with a stone. But in the moment of clarity, the doctor realizes what he's doing is wrong and manages to resist the pull of the planet's pull, turning away from the violence. The master demands that they finish their fight, but the doctor tries to convince him to let go of the violence too, pointing out that they will destroy both the planet and themselves if they keep fighting. The master, however, rejects this, and grabbing the doctor in a stranglehold, he spitefully tells him that he should have killed him while he had the chance. The doctor screams out, "If we fight like animals, we die like animals!" As the master raises a club over his head to hit him with it. But before the master can strike him, the doctor is teleported away. The master is left for dead as the planet begins to break up. The doctor has gone back to the TARDIS in Earth, his homes, where he finds Ace. Her metamorphosis has reversed. He tells her that she has grown through the experience. The elements of the cheetah planet will, however, remain with her forever. Ace is glad. It gave her a wonderful feeling. She then asks what happened to the master. "Who knows?" answers the doctor with a hint of sadness before he asks Ace where they should go now. "Home," answers Ace with a smile. "The TARDIS."
So there's a lot to unpack here, and I'm sure we'll get to it, but I do need to take a moment to talk about Midge's late 80s badass outfit with the leather sleeves and the sunglasses is peak late 80s.
Do you do thumbnails for this podcast? Because you could really use that one.
Sadly, we don't. But seriously, Google up, because that is just him with the tie and everything. It's like he looks like a villain out of a Karate Kid movie.
The whole Patterson thing.
Yeah.
God, what's the line from the Karate Kid? "Don't be a pussy, be a badass."
Right.
But yeah, I mean, it's very much of the same era, even though this is not an episode actually about that kind of thing.
No, but one of the things that I do enjoy about Survival is kind of what's happening on a metatextual level, which is that Doctor Who has never been a show about this kind of macho solving of problems, right? It's always been a show about thinking through the problems. So it's neat that it kind of sets up, okay, let's shoot up the archetypal 80s badass character and then watch him completely fail. And so it's a nice little way of saying these kinds of characters do not do well in Doctor Who's universe.
Oh yeah, they never do.
If even they're even not the written by Eric Saylor. Like,
well, right, yeah.
But like, you go back to Harry Sullivan, who is very charming and likable, but like, punching never works out for him. Like, it never does. And although he always accepts the doctor's explanation for why he should not be punching, or why the punching did not work, he more or less keeps trying it.
It's true. It's true.
So yeah, even the lovable, violent characters tend not to get much done. Only Jack, really, much later.
True, and I think he only gets by because he is American.
That's true, and also, I mean, I remember something Davey said in the Book of Treatments and Scripts.
Mm-hmm.
He says, yeah, Jack is there because the doctor cannot shoot someone at the end of this season.
Mm.
But, yeah. These characters never do well.
No. Anyway, but I just wanted to bring that up. But I mean, more to the point, like the larger thing is, this is when I was talking before about Ainley being probably at his best, in the sense that this is the master straight up manipulating and possessing someone, kind of riding them to death. It's the perfect balance of charm and menace that is frequently missing from a lot of master performances. And so this is a really good example of him so explicitly using someone as a pawn. But he usually doesn't, it's usually done in more of an abstract intellectual way. This is a very personal discarding of someone's life that I've really always found very visceral and satisfying.
Yeah. And it's one of the things that Ainley is really good at.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you see the manipulation stuff happen back on back in the final fourth Doctor serial.
Legopolis.
I am blanking on the name. But you see him pose as Tremis.
Right.
And he does that very effectively in his, like, I mean, he's only had, like, half an outing before this.
Right.
So it really works. And I think, you know, in this episode, you can see that the Master and the Doctor don't ever really want to kill each other. The Master says things like, you should have killed me when you had the chance, when you had the chance. But, like, even under the influence of the planet, you know that was at best secondary.
Right.
He might be willing to kill the Doctor. He might, like, be really angry and about to kill the Doctor. But fundamentally, none of his plans ever involve killing the Doctor as a critical step.
Right.
That's true across all the Masters, basically. Although they all have their different personality reasons.
Right. I mean, the Tim Doctor is probably the closest one to ever seriously consider as a possibility, even though he turns away from it.
I mean, Delgado always just wanted to prove that he was smarter and correct.
Right.
Which,
you know, mood.
I mean, I think most Doctor Who fans can relate to that.
Right. A lot happens in this episode, frankly. Again, shows you how well-paced this season is. They're really got things sorted out. I did like the little bit of when Ace brings them home and is like, you know, we're going home, and she appears next to the TARDIS. it's a neat little touch that gets paid off at the end of the episode, that that's where she considers home. And of course, so when the doctor does the same thing, he shows up at the exact same spot. It's a nice show don't tell moment that, frankly, classic Doctor Who doesn't always do very well.
Yeah. This whole season is really good Ace episodes.
Yeah.
And this is kind of the send-off she needs. Obviously, next season would have been a more smoothly built-up exit for her. But, as ending on the coming home to the TARDIS thing is a really solid Ace character beat.
Yeah. Yeah. It does have the lingering thing of the cheetah planet allows you part of you, which is something weirdly I don't think any of the tie-in media has ever really picked up on. I think that'd be something to latch onto.
How would you tell an aggressive cat person from regular Ace if she's not trying to claw people to death and eat them?
Yeah, fair. Like,
exactly how does that really change Ace that she's got a bit of aggressive cat in her?
She'd wear a cat suit, carry a big gun, and shoot creatures and people. Oh wait, she does that. That virgin.
I mean, a cat suit is not necessarily a cat suit. There are like two kinds of cat suit. But yeah, I think
they call it a cat suit in the book.
It's a nice touch there, but I can see why it didn't come up again because it doesn't change her much.
True. But given the propensity for early 90s Doctor Who writers to grab every little scrap of continuity and shove it into their products, that's why I'm surprised. I'm not saying it needed to be there. I am surprised it's not. These are people who are like, I'm going to write an entire novel just to reconcile two lines of dialogue between two Silurian episodes. This is the caliber of writer we're usually talking about here.
I mean, and that's how you get over-explained mysteries.
Right.
There's all this stuff, and it really starts with this season again,
mm-hmm.
where the Doctor starts mentioning epic things that are most likely never going to be practical to show. Right. You see that, Curse of Fenric. Although that's more on Fenric's side speaking.
Mm-hmm.
But then you have Davies talking about the Crux and the Nightmare Child.
Mm-hmm.
And all of these things that you can't show them for money reasons, but also they don't really fit in on TV. I think the only time that's really been paid off, and surprisingly it worked, is with the moment.
Mm.
Actually, that worked out as a fairly solid incarnation of what was just one of those Davies lines. Right. But, the Seventh Doctor, to build up the mystery that Cartmel wanted to do, starts throwing those things in here. And it's cool.
Yeah. I mean, even that last bit that you read, I mean, like, he's talking about sleeping seas and people made of smoke and rivers dreaming. It's like, you're right, this is stuff that we can't televise, but it gives a certain kind of almost, I hate to say it, but chthonic quality to the Seventh Doctor that marries really well with him, arguing with angels and fighting gods from the ends of time. It really sets up this idea and something I started talking about with Battlefield is that the Doctor by the end of the season becomes mythic. And that's something that the new season definitely, or the 2005 version definitely builds on in very interesting directions. And it's just not quite, I mean, you see bits of it in season 25, mostly around Remembrance of the Daleks, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea that the Doctor fundamentally changes, because you're right, this idea of adding the mystery to the Doctor becomes, what if we just have him name drop weird shit? And it really works.
Yeah, I really enjoy that part of Doctor Who.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But even the stuff they show, even the stuff they're showing, like, you know, I mean, when you hear Chris read the summary, you have to go, okay, the Master and the Doctor are fighting because they're being possessed by a living planet made of bipedal cheetahs who teleport through space and time. It's bonkers. Which is peak Doctor Who, right? Doctor Who is at its sweet spot when it is just throwing bizarre ideas at you, and you're going, yeah, no, okay, that makes sense.
because the Doctor and Ace make sense to us.
Right.
I mean, it's odd to think of Seven as a grounding character, but he always is. But we get how Seven and Ace are working. We understand them, and the supporting cast relationships are pretty easy to follow. So the fact that it's bonkers doesn't actually make the episodes confusing.
Right. It helps that the Ace has the same quality that the Brigadier has, which is to completely no-sell nonsense.
Yes.
Both characters, Doctor will go, let me explain a bunch of nonsense to you. They both go, okay, what can I do?
Yeah. Also, Harry there.
True, but Harry did it because he was just perpetually overwhelmed and kind of was like, okay, sure, I guess. Whereas the Brigadier's like, right, can I shoot it? Why N? If N, and it's usually N, okay, what's the next plan?
Yeah. And this season, we get Seven and the Brigadier.
Yeah.
And it's probably
a much better Brigadier exit story than the last one.
Well, yeah, because the last one was conceived for Ian.
Right.
Yeah.
But, like, the Brigadier here, this is a very plausible retirement for him. His relationship to the Doctor is very clearly one of a man who has known this person three other times to various extents.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, the Brigadier sees the Doctor in the very different Doctor because they were friends and co-workers.
Right.
But that's Battlefield. This is Survival.
Right, right. But again, it shows you kind of an interesting arc to get back to Survival, in the sense that in Battlefield, especially Ace's discussion with the Brigadier, contradiction with the Brigadier, is that Ace didn't realize, I can't always use bombs to solve problems.
Yeah, I mean, that's something they have in common.
Right, and by the time we get to Survival, Ace is actively trying to emulate the Doctor, and we see that particularly in this episode with relationship with Kara. She's trying to use the Doctor's methods of connecting with someone. And interestingly, when Ace is being Ace with Kara in episode 2, they bonded really well. When Ace tries to be the Doctor with Kara in episode 3, Kara pushes her away a bit more.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, and this is actually in the plan for next season and kind of happens in the new adventures. Ace is the first of the companions who slowly grows into being the Doctor.
Mm-hmm.
We see that with Rose. Mm-hmm. We see that, we see that with a lot of companions later.
Mm-hmm.
They
Sarah Jane does it by herself. Well,
having to some extent become the Doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. Perhaps the best line from the Doctor about that is 12 to Clara, where she says, so was I good? And the Doctor says, no, but you were an excellent Doctor.
Mm-hmm.
But that's kind of this thing. Some of the companions, and it happens the first time here, grow up to be, you know, from the Doctor's mentoring or failure to mentor, they take on aspects of the Doctor's role, but don't stop being themselves.
Right.
the way we know the Doctor sometimes does themselves.
Right, right. I mean, the only other characters that kind of approach this is Romana, but doesn't count because she's kind of already in Ersatz's Doctor to begin with from day one.
Mm-hmm.
Being a Time Lord. So that doesn't quite count. If anything, she has the opposite arc where she grows to becoming herself over her arc before she leaves. And Leela, because the Doctor's explicitly training her in the same way that we see the Doctor explicitly training Ace, except for Leela rejects pretty much immediately his approach to things and just says, nope, violence is definitely always the answer. Whereas Ace kind of goes, okay, violence is great, but maybe there are other options by the time we hit the survival.
I think Ace gets to understand the difference between you accomplish a specific goal with explosives rather than, well, I've got some explosives, we should use them on everything.
Right.
I'm not sure how much that was Sophie Aldred and how much it was the writing, because clearly both, but I'm not sure what portion it is because I haven't researched it. But, like, yeah, she learns.
Mm-hmm.
And Leela sort of learns, actually. Leela understands what she's rejecting by the last time she rejects it.
Right, right, right. It's not that she's doing it out of ignorance. She's doing it out of choice, which is still cool for Leela. It's a cool arc. It's just a very different arc. Whereas Ace is like, no, I want to be like you. Show me how. And then here we see, again, if we had another season, we'd probably see this complete. But right now we see her moving from, my methods don't always work, to I'm trying to apply the Doctor's methods. And arguably, even Curse of Fenric, she's trying a different version of the Doctor's methods. Like, I'm going to try to convince a soldier, but rather than baffle and bamboozle them, I'm going to try to use feminine wiles because that's a technique I know I have that you don't have in your arsenal. And wait, boys, forget it. Let me just collapse here accidentally because this is not working well.
I will say that if one of the Doctors, particularly a 2005 Doctor,
mm-hmm.
If they had tried to distract someone with flirting that way, honestly, I'd have bought it. It's not their case. But if the Doctor was going to do a seduction, the Doctor would probably talk like that.
That is more than fair. And now I want to see Eccleston doing that scene, and that just sounds amazing.
That quick note on Eccleston. There was a line I didn't notice until my last rewatch last year in the Doctor dances that I can't believe nobody has mentioned to me, and I haven't seen seen as the trigger for anything directly on AO3. Jack steps into the TARDIS and says, bigger on the inside, and Nine says, you better be. And I'm like, how did I not notice that in the original? How have I not seen it in any of the fanfic of friends I knew who was writing at the time? How have I not seen that in any attempt to, I don't know, like, how is that, like, something that's not one of the, I don't know.
That's a more iconic line, right?
I mean, that is their relationship.
Right.
I mean, it's complicated to define that, but, like, I mean, this is Nine and Jack. Nine reciprocates Jack's crush, which Ken does not.
Right, right. Yeah.
But anyway, yeah, just as a point on how some flirting works for the Doctor that would not work for the companions and, you know, Fenric. It's a good idea to flirt to distract the guard in that case.
Right.
I mean, that's kind of a thing that that a Doctor Who character would and could do, but
right, but Seven can't do it. It's not in his toolbox.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like if 11 had tried to flirt or something
God.
That. But yeah, I love Fenric, but there are, like, I think it's the best Seven episode, but there are some bits in there that are just short bits. They're baffling.
Oh, yeah.
Which we don't have here in Survival. And I don't just mean Ace doesn't flirt badly. I mean, like, Ace and the Doctor are the characters who carry us through this very weird journey.
Well, and that's such a good kind of segue into the overall discussion of the serial is that something I noted in Battlefields and we talked about is one of the reasons why we didn't ultimately cover Ghostlight is because Andrew Cartmell was very bad at estimating how much script page turned into how much screen time. And so you can see, particularly in Ghostlight, but even in Battlefield and Curse of Fenric, heavy editing. And I argued in both of those that the editing was generally to the serial's benefits. Again, Ghostlight, we didn't talk about, and we probably should at some point just to finish this out. But
that's a really we should do a special one just for it.
Yeah, maybe.
At this point.
Because it is a good case of how too much editing can actually really hinder a thing. But in both Battlefield and Curse of Fenric, yeah, there are occasionally baffling moments, like in Battlefield, Bambera kicking the Doctor out, and then immediately the next scene driving him in a car. It's like, okay, there's too much cut here. But no, generally,
no, 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 it feels like losses like that.
Right. And it gives it kind of a almost 2005 pacing, which is odd. But then we hit to Survival, and again, it's so frustrating because we've hit the right balance. Survival does not overstay its welcome, but it's also paced well. It correctly assumes we should spend at least an entire episode in Perryvale before we go to Strange Alien Planet. It does a really good job. Nothing feels forced in, but nothing feels like it's left out. I can't think of anything that this episode's fundamentally missing that's really a problem. It's just a well-paced bit of television that, I mean, with a little bit of reorganization, it could probably be condensed down to 45 minutes. But frankly, it just doesn't need it. It just works as is. It's the first part of the season that hasn't felt a little too cut to the bone. And then it's like, cool, so now that you figured it out, go find new work.
Well, actually, that the pacing keeps coming up and that we read the summary out loud points out something. I mean, I am very much a person who analyzes and attempts to use story structure. It works to my benefit as a writer, I think. But also, I just look at this stuff. And this is three episodes that managed to both hit the Sid Field three-act benefits, but also their episodes. You can sit, you can watch one of them, like people did, and then not watch the next for a week, you know? It's neat that it's both a good serial and a beautifully structured story if you watch it all at once. That's really... Again, they really hit their stride here.
Yeah. And to your point, like, it's not quite what we would call in comic book terms writing to the trade in the sense of an individual episode is itself unsatisfying because actually each individual episode does have a bit of three-act structure inside of it. So we have kind of almost nested three-act structures, which is a very clever bit of writing, frankly.
Yeah. Like... I think a lot of the older serials tend to use a four or five act structure, but that doesn't align to the episode breaks.
No.
Like, I think the best structured story in general of classic Who is The Demons.
Yeah.
Because no one pronounces that correctly in the, or never, nobody pronounces that consistently in the episode.
Right.
Star Trek would later invent giving actors a whole pronunciation guide.
Oh, that's smart.
With the scripts. But anyway, I think that is a solidly structured and probably the best structured serial of Doctor Who. It's so frustrating that we didn't get more of these characters in this way. You know, more episodes like this. It's a shame.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Various people did things with the characters in the lore. Big Finish, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But it would have been really nice to get another season of, you know, this.
Right. And it's pretty clear that that's what Russell T. Davies is trying to do with the first season of 2005 show, right?
Was
the, okay, let's take survival conceptually and stretch it out to an entire season. Let's build up a cast of characters. Let's revisit them occasionally. Some characters, in retrospect, have been handled better than others, but still the idea of having almost a soap opera style of these characters grow and change and evolve, and Rose comes back to them, and we see how she has evolved and changed through the viewpoints of these characters. That's something that very well could have been done with the Perivale cast of characters.
Yeah, it is. And I think, I think there are particular things that are strong influences later. Seven, obviously. Also Claremont's X-Men.
Mm-hmm.
And that's right. The reason I bring that up isn't a random note. It's because the soap opera element from this and from off-screen in Ghostlight, that's kind of developed with that comic book approach to it later.
Right.
Yeah, I would have liked more Perivale episodes. I really would have.
Yeah.
Even though I know that ultimately the speculative plan was to have Ace go to the Time Lord Academy. I mean, wasn't that the plan, or did I get it wrong?
No, you're right. It's absolutely right. But I'm still baffled as to how that works. I've seen a couple of people try to take stabs at how that works, and it just never.
Well, I mean, what is a Time Lord Academy?
Right.
It's part of the running joke through 3 and 4 that the Doctor is some kind of academic, and the Master the name the Master was picked because it's another academic title.
Right, and a lesser one, which is hilarious.
I really don't know how you would say, how you would do the Ace, we're enrolling you in school thing. I don't see how it would have worked, but the beat there is one I would have liked to see. Ace goes and learns the things the Doctor has learned, you know, in science and magic bullshit.
That's a PhD in magic bullshit.
Misto babble, I sometimes call it. But that as an exit, you know, just becoming a time traveler, which is also what they did in the New Adventures.
Right.
That would have been the right exit for Ace. But at least here we have a good establishing point of what would have gone on. This one isn't an unsatisfying ending to the series.
No, not completely. Chris, do you have any other thoughts about this whole serial?
No, I just think that we're going to need to cover Ghostlight before we wrap up. Actually, the more I think about it now, given we've covered the other ones.
Can I come back for Ghostlight? That episode is fascinating.
We'll have to talk about that offline. Now I have to restructure everything. I have to reorganize all my stuff. That's what we get for organizing. It's my because now we have to do this stuff. But assuming we don't cover that, I think we're all in agreement that at least season 26 is one of the best seasons of Doctor Who. I still maintain it's probably the best season of classic Doctor Who.
Utter agreement.
I would discuss that with you, but I agree completely.
Right. And so it's continues to be frustrating even today to see the show end on such a high note. But if it did not end on a high note, I do not know if we would have Doctor Who on the screens today.
We certainly wouldn't have the same one.
No. I think the fact that it lasted beyond this as a show, had a, you know, 96 had a brief attempt at it, but the fact it was successfully rebooted in 2005 ultimately stems from the fact that this show showed its potential at the last moment, and arguably even literally, right? Like, this serial is a really strong story. You know, Rosa's second best. I can't argue with that, but only because there's not a bad story in this season, frankly.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're all bangers.
Right. I mean, as much as people argue about which Doctor Who shows are classic and whatnot, there, you can't point to another season of Doctor Who and go, every single episode is damn near a classic.
Oh, man, when Ace comes back and she turns out she's been stashing the jacket under the floorboards in her office? That's, like, so fucking Ace. Because, you know, like, I know this is the future show, but you get her back and she's, like, clearly applying her aceness in more practical ways. But then she fucking loves putting on her jacket and jumping out of an exploding building.
Right.
Ace is great. That's all I'm really saying.
No argument, I think, on this podcast.
No. And I mean, if nothing else, one of the things I love about season 26 is the fact that you can talk about Sarah Jane Smith, you can talk about Leela, you can talk about all of the classic companions, and rightfully so, but rarely has there been pre-2005 moments of Doctor Who where the companion could comfortably and justifiably sit equally with the Doctor on the screen.
Yeah.
And so that's one of the reasons why I've always had a soft spot for Ace. Plus, of course, I was a teenage boy at the time when Ace came across my purview, so a certain amount of crush comes from that.
You probably have a crush for the same reason I have a wants to be like.
Right. Exactly. She's such an amazing character. And also it really helps that Sophie Aldred is everything I've heard is that she is
incredible.
Such an amazing actor and person in real life, too. She's always been a huge supporter of Doctor Who and people around Doctor Who.
And she managed to write. I shouldn't say managed. That sounds a little dismissive. But, like, at childhood's end,
yeah,
is very good.
I've still not read it yet. I keep meaning to.
Like, Scratch Man is the only other. I mean, there have been a few novels by people involved with the show, mm-hmm. but that and Scratch Man are the ones where you see how well the performers understood their era.
And Scratch Man is just as fucking bonkers as Tom Baker is.
Yeah. And you know what? You know, I don't know how much of that Goss wrote, but I have seen a lot about the treatment and script that Baker and Ian Martyr?
Ian Martyr. Yeah, Ian Martyr.
Wrote, which was basically the same kind of psychedelic.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm talking about porn. I'll wind this up quickly. But you can see Harry is absolutely at his dumbest in Scratch Man.
Yes.
In a way that you can tell is Baker's affection for the character. Yeah. And quite possibly that's what Martyr thought his character was like.
Oh, that's absolutely true.
But I say this to point out how at childhood's end is Aldred showing how well she understands the character she was playing.
I need to get on that, honestly.
It's very good. I didn't go through most of it as the audio, but the audio is very good.
Hmm. Does she read it?
Sophie Aldred reads it. She's read one or two other of the 13 era books that I haven't listened to.
Hmm.
But anyway, yeah. This season and then later on, both actors really get why this works.
Yeah.
And it's both excellent to see it as the last episode and very frustrating.
100%. That's absolutely how I feel, is that if it had to go, this is a great way to go. I mean, imagine if this show had ended on, like, I don't know, the Happiness Patrol, right?
Yeah.
I love Happiness Patrol, but it's not a high watermark, you know?
I like most of the serials, but some of them are, you know, some of them are classic to the Doctors that they are.
Mm-hmm.
And this one is, I keep saying it, this is just Seven and Ace at the seven and acest parts of the, you know, it's the right note to go out on. And the text on the back of my game, Beautiful Anomalies, which started as a Doctor Who game, mm-hmm. is entirely inspired by this speech. I'm not going to go too far in plugging it, but, like, there are a few bits that were inspired directly. And the back cover text of that book is one of them, where I, every bloody battlefield and perfect Christmas and perhaps one turning into the other. You can see where I'm stealing from this.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, if there aren't any other closing thoughts about this, we can actually do the wrap up. And this gives you a chance to pitch your work where people can find you and embrace everything you do and to give you more money so you keep doing it.
Oh, I love that. You know, I am a writer. I love it when people give me attention. And so, Beautiful Anomalies is kind of a wrinkle in time meets Doctor Who, and but it goes way beyond that. And especially the second edition, which I'm writing right now with a collaborator, my most frequent collaborator, Audrey Whitman.
Mm-hmm.
Total fucking genius. But my current project is actually fiction, which I'm funding via my Patreon. It's a post-apocalyptic sort of diesel punk. But the point is that the machines conquered us, the vampires saved us, and our hero is a violent dropout. Catriona Saxon, and the serial, the name probably gives you a better idea than anything I just said. It's called Dirty Dracula Divas.
Where can people find that stuff at?
You can find the episodes come out in advance, and there are polls and stuff at patreon.com /fantasyheartbreaker. On a delay, they are posted to Scribble Hub, which is a fiction posting site with a very large queer and trans community.
Nice.
I'll have to give you the link for that. It would be slightly annoying to say it out loud because the URL has the title in it.
Fair enough.
But I will send the link over, and please check out my stuff. Enjoy my nonsense.
And Chris, if people wanted to enjoy your nonsense, where would they find you?
They can come to the Patreon. That's Darker Hughes. Actually, it's Harlem Unbound and Chris Biven Patreon. You can come to the website, or the best place that I'd prefer you to come is a Discord, so you can constantly see the memes I'm sending at Eddie right now repeatedly to get him to acknowledge one of them.
I'm continuing to no sell the memes. But if you're also looking for me, I also have a Patreon now. I've joined the Cool Kids Club. My Patreon is at Pugsteady, where I am releasing Pugmire fiction. So I have I have one story out there, but I have more in the pipeworks planned, including my Sherlock Holmes / Jeeves and Wooster mashup with dogs. So I look forward to. But yes, if you want to talk to us about genreless, feel free to come to the Discord. We have a genreless channel. We talk about all sorts of stuff on the Darker Hue Discord. Rose, thank you very much for being on and for proving exactly why I wanted you on the show. Because always great to talk to you.
I have a last thing I want to say to you.
Is it airable? I know that you've got a lot of things to say, but can we air them in public Discord?
Well, but seriously, write up the historian as a time traveler or time lord. Just please give us that character, because I'm sitting here looking at the label on the screen and listening to you talk about Doctor Who. And I'm like, we need to know how you would play this character.
It is my video game handle for many things.
Well, there you go.
That tells me what kind of memes to send you if I run into you in a video game.
And with that, we will maybe say goodbye to the Seventh Doctor era. We're not sure yet, but certainly...
I mean, you really should do Ghostlight, whether I'm there or not.
Right. But if nothing else, Chris and I do have some future plans to talk about some more Doctor Who stuff, but we will reveal those in the near future. But until then, we'll see you all next week.
Well, thank you very much for having me on.
Listening.